Today on Path of Grace.
If we believe that first definition about God, do you think it might make us more like Paul and Silas, who, after being beaten and thrown into jail for their faith, were able to sing songs of praise? Would it mean that we would be more like, let's say, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Remember when King Nebuchadnezzar threatened to throw them into the fiery furnace because they refused to bow and worship that big statue? And they said, "King, go ahead and throw us into the fire. But we want you to know, our God can deliver us. But even if he doesn't, even if he lets us burn in your furnace, we are not going to bow to your statue." Think about that. King, you can do what you want. Throw us in the fire. Our God, the true God, he can deliver us. But even if he chooses not to, even if he doesn't, wow. Let me ask you what may sound like a strange question. How God is God? What? How God is God? The God you worship. How God is that God? In other words, how much does God control? Has anything taken God by surprise? Does anything ever slip through the fingers of God? Is the will of God ever thwarted? Are these silly questions? I don't think so. I think they are vital questions. They are incredibly important questions. And the answers that you have to those questions, what you believe about God, your view of God, I'm convinced is going to have a huge impact on your life every day and an impact on the amount of peace you experience throughout life. Do you see God as one who is just scrambling to keep things in order, kind of like the circus performer balancing the spinning plates on the end of sticks? Have you ever seen that? They've got several sticks protruding up from the floor, and the performer gets a plate spinning on top of one stick, then he runs to the next, he starts that plate spinning, then onto the next, gets that one spinning, and he goes back and forth, spinning those plates in an attempt to not let any of them fall and splatter on the ground. He put everything spinning in place, but at any moment, it could become too much for him, and things will spin out of control, everything will fall apart in shambles on the floor. Is that how you see God? Does he need a little help making sure things don't come crashing down in shambles? You imagine God as one who set things in motion, but he's kind of taking a hands-off approach. Not really in control of much, but he does have the ability to see the future, so he talks about the future in the Bible. But he's basically just watching from the sidelines. He set things in motion, but now he's just watching, observing, not taking an active part. Do you imagine God in an epic battle like in the movies? You have God on one side, the devil on the other. They're fighting it out. And God has control of some things. The devil has control of other things. And they're just like smacking each other like Rocky and that Russian guy, Drago, in Rocky IV. How do you see God? How much God is the God you believe in? Out of curiosity this morning, I decided to look up the word God on Merriam-Webster.com. And I want you to listen carefully to these definitions. Perhaps you'll hear one that fits your view of God. Definition number one: the supreme or ultimate authority, the being perfect in power, wisdom, and goodness, who is worshipped as creator and ruler of the universe. Number two: a being or object believed to have more than natural attributes and powers, and to require human worship, specifically one controlling a particular aspect or part of reality. Number three, a person or thing of supreme value. Number four, a powerful ruler. Now, did you notice those definitions cover a wide range? Number one was the ultimate supreme, who is perfect in power, wisdom, and goodness, who is the creator and ruler of all. And number four was simply a powerful ruler. Now, I think the definition that fits the idea most people have of God is actually definition number two. Listen to that one again. A being believed to have more than natural abilities and powers, and to require human worship, specifically one controlling a particular aspect or part of reality. Did you catch the last part of that phrase? A being who is controlling a particular aspect or part of reality. Now, there is a huge difference in definition number one and definition number two. Here's definition number one again. The being perfect in power, wisdom, and goodness, who is worshipped as creator and ruler of the universe. That would leave nothing out of it, which would mean that he is right now and always has been, working all things according to his will, and he has no equal. He is one whose will cannot be thwarted in any way by anyone. He is the ultimate ruler, the one who created all that exists, everything out there. Therefore, there is nothing that exists that he didn't put in place. He is one who has perfect wisdom and perfect goodness and does things the way he does, ultimately for the good of all that he has created. That's really what definition number one is telling us. That other definition, a being with more than natural abilities and powers that requires human worship and controls a particular aspect or part of reality, not the whole universe, but part of it. That's a God who may have created, but there are things that have happened, things that exist that are outside of his will, outside of his plan, things that he never intended, things which then would have to be beyond his control. Think about it. If God is in control of certain things or part of reality, a certain aspect, as that definition says, that would mean that God is not in control of all things, which would mean that there are things outside of his control, which when you carry that thinking out, means that his will could be thwarted and most likely has been. And if it's happened once, it could happen again. And since he doesn't truly rule over all things, but instead only a certain portion or part of reality, there's a lot going on outside of his will and outside of his control, which means this God or this picture of God needs a lot of help to accomplish his will. And sadly, because he doesn't truly rule over all, man, he'd be kind of hard to trust, wouldn't he? Be kind of tough to rely on to accomplish things he said he would accomplish if he's a God who needs someone else's help. Now think about this, and we've talked about this in the past. If God's will can be thwarted even once, if at any point something happened that was not his will, like for instance, the serpent entering into Eden and what's called the fall of man, if the serpent somehow outwitted or outpowered God, snuck in under the radar, and completely botched up God's plan, which is what I've basically been taught most of my life, then how can we rest? If God's plan for Eden was completely made a mess by the serpent outside of what God had willed to happen, how could you know that the serpent might botch the rest up? How could we rest in any plans God might have for you and me if he couldn't keep Eden together according to his will? If he was bested once, could he not be bested again? And how scary would that be? And how much pressure would that place on you and me to have to help God not be bested again? With a God like that, how could we have hope? Again, if his will has ever been thwarted at any time, if something happened outside of his power, if he wasn't in control, how do we know he won't ever lose control of everything? On the other hand, if God is truly God, the being perfect in power, wisdom, and goodness who is worshipped as creator and ruler of the universe, as it's stated in that first definition from Merriam-Webster, that would mean that nothing has ever slipped through his fingers, nothing ever will. Everything that has ever happened is somehow working for the ultimate good of his creation, even if it doesn't make much sense to us in the midst of it. And I don't know about you, but there's a lot I experience in life that doesn't make sense. There's a lot I see in the world that seems senseless, but since he is perfect in wisdom and perfect in goodness, we will ultimately see and understand that the way he has done all things was the perfect way to do it. At the end of the ages, the end of the aeons, when, according to the Apostle Paul, God becomes all in all, and we finally all go, ah, I get it. We're going to see there's no other way that God could have done this. Now, if we truly believed definition number one about God, I think that would mean we probably would have some peace. It might raise a lot of other questions, but it would also give us more peace, regardless of our circumstances. If we believe that first definition about God, do you think it might make us more like Paul and Silas, who, after being beaten and thrown into jail for their faith, were able to sing songs of praise? If we truly saw God, according to that first definition in Merriam-Webster, would it mean that we would be more like, let's say, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Remember when King Nebuchadnezzar threatened to throw them into the fiery furnace because they refused to bow and worship that big statue? And they said, King, go ahead and throw us into the fire. But we want you to know, our God can deliver us. But even if he doesn't, even if he lets us burn in your furnace, we are not going to bow to your statue. Think about that. King, you can do what you want. Throw us in the fire. Our God, the true God, he can deliver us. But even if he chooses not to, even if he doesn't, wow. They had an amazing picture of God, didn't they? They saw God as being God, regardless of the physical circumstances and regardless of their experience. They knew that God was still God and that God had a purpose in everything, including that big if he didn't deliver them from the fiery, agonizing death in that furnace at the hands of King Nebuchadnezzar. Over and over, as you look at scripture, God says things like, I am God. Now, the basic Hebrew word for God is El, E-L. The Hebrews then would add other words after El to expand upon the meaning and help us to have a bigger picture of God. But the word El basically means this, subjector or placer. And scripture tells us that El, God, the subjector, the placer, is able to do all. He knows all. He is everywhere all the time. There is nowhere you can go to escape from his presence. There is no place that he isn't. He is the producer of all, the supplier, the sustainer, the planner. He orders all. He directs all. He's the author. He is the finisher. He is the God who is truly God, the absolute God, sovereign of the universe. Now, the sad thing is that many have been taught and believe that God is less than that, more like a definition number two God. The view so many hold of God is like, well, he's just a poor God who can't seem to truly manage to do exactly what he wants to do. And the big bummer is that God is actually subject to his creatures. His creatures can actually get the upper hand, whether it was a serpent in Eden who botched up God's plans or humanity, which is just messing up God's plans. His will is subject to the will of those that he created. The creation has the final say. Now, a lot of people wouldn't exactly word it that way, but when you look at what's taught and how people live, that's pretty much the view. I'm convinced that view is not true. I believe God is God. I believe he's absolutely and completely God, and that nothing has slipped through his fingers, that he's not scrambling, he's not wringing his hands, oh, I really hope I can somehow get this to come together. Maybe if I get enough help from humanity, I can bring my plans to pass. That's not God. Now, am I saying that God doesn't have things for us to do? No. Am I saying God doesn't want us involved? No, he wants us involved. That's what he created us for, to be involved. There's things for us to do. Ephesians 2:10 tells us God has created things for us to do. But everything doesn't hinge on us. It's all about God. In that same letter, Ephesians chapter 1, verse 11, the Apostle Paul tells us that God works all things according to the counsel of his will. Now, that is a strong statement that a lot of people would probably like to highlight with a black highlighter and just scratch it out of their Bible, because it can be startling to think about, that God works all things according to the counsel of his will. Think about humanity. All the weakness, the frailty, the apparent failure on an individual scale in your life and my life and on a huge universal scale, all of humanity. There's a lot of yuck, isn't there? Is God working all of that according to his will? Is there a purpose behind it? Did God design things to be the way they are for a specific reason? I think so. Scripture tells us that God is a potter and we are the clay. It also speaks of, at times, the clay being marred in the hands of the potter and then being reformed and shaped. So think about that. We're the clay, he's the potter, and there are times when we are marred. What's that tell us? It tells us that everything in your life and my life, including the marring, the painful things, it's by design. It's all taking place in the Father's hands. Scripture doesn't tell us that we are marred because we slipped from the potter's hands or that it's because we jumped out of the potter's hands. Nope. It all happens in the potter's hands, which means that the only marring that takes place is not only marring that he has allowed, but which he is ultimately the craftsman of, the artist. He is the potter. He has planned his design and he is working it in our lives, molding and shaping and forming us. We are the clay. He is the potter. And Paul tells us in Ephesians 1, he's working all things according to the counsel of his will. What's that mean? Again, that even those things in life that seem to be against us, even those are ultimately serving a purpose, his purpose. A good purpose for you and for me. One of the greatest examples of this is the life of Joseph. Remember Joseph? Back in the book of Genesis, he was sold off as a slave by his brothers who hated him. They were envious of him. He was then falsely accused of rape. He's thrown into prison. He's forgotten about there. And a couple of decades of pure misery are what this guy experienced. But then, through an interesting turn of events, he's raised up to second in command in all of Egypt. And because he was put in that position, God was able to really save thousands and thousands of people from starvation, including all of his brothers and all of what would become the nation of Israel. And finally, in Genesis chapter 50, he meets his brothers again face to face, the ones who had hated him and envied him and sold him off as a slave. And he said this, "You meant this as evil against me, but God meant it for good." That's startling. God meant it. You meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, to save many people alive. See, God meant it. God was doing it. God was working, doing something that was beyond Joseph and his own personal comfort level and convenience. God was working in and through all of it, including the actions of his brothers. His brothers, guys who at this point in their lives were full of jealousy and envy, very, very ugly things in their lives, right? God worked in it and through it. The brothers, through their actions, were fulfilling the purpose of God. They were fulfilling the will of God, which was ultimately to preserve many, many people from starvation, again, by having Joseph in Egypt as a prisoner to be raised up at a particular point in time to second in command of Egypt. Now, the brothers' thoughts, their intents, from any human perspective, would have been seen as absolute evil, horrific, rotten. Think about it. To sell their brother as a slave, that's horrible. For Joseph to be falsely accused of rape, that's evil, no doubt. To be forgotten about in prison, that's evil. Yet Joseph, the one who it all happened to, reached the place ultimately where he looked back on it, every bit of it, and he said, "You guys thought it for evil, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good." And I think we can safely say that at that point in time, Joseph would have said, "And it was all worth it." The Apostle Paul experienced such painful times in his life. He said that he despaired of life. In other words, he couldn't stand life. It hurt too much. He would have preferred at times to simply be dead. Circumstances were that painful. Have you ever been there? Paul was beaten up on multiple occasions. He was stoned and left for dead. He was locked up, shipwrecked, bitten by a snake. He experienced times of near starvation, having no place to lay his head at night. He talked about being in perils of robbers and in perils of his own countrymen. Everywhere he went, he was in perils. There were a lot of people that hated the guy. Yet that same apostle would tell us in Ephesians 1 that God is working all things according to the counsel of his will. All things, including Paul experiencing all that Paul experienced. Now you might be saying, "But James, my bald friend, that can't possibly include the stuff Paul was going through. That evil, rotten stuff couldn't possibly have been the will of God for Paul's life or the life of anyone else. There is no purpose it could possibly serve. Can't be of God." Are you sure? There's no purpose? It can't be of God? What about teaching Paul about forgiveness? What about teaching Paul how to show mercy? What about teaching Paul how to extend grace? See, the only way Paul could learn to forgive was by having people in his life who would need forgiveness greatly because they had wronged him so horribly. The only way Paul would learn to show mercy was by having people come into his life who would need mercy after wronging him. The only way to learn to extend grace was by having people in his life, people who crossed his path, who deserved nothing good, but who Paul would be able to reach out to in love. Let me ask you something. How is it that you learn to show grace? How do you learn to show mercy, compassion, and forgiveness? It's by being surrounded by people who need it, people just like you. Why is it that God has placed you in the path of other people? It's for the same reason, so they can learn to show grace, mercy, and compassion, and forgiveness by extending it to you, because you really need it, don't you? Think about God. How could God have ever hoped to demonstrate to all of creation that he is merciful, compassionate, forgiving, and gracious? He had to do it by creating beings, us, who desperately need those things. Now, as we wrap up, I want to give you some homework, a few passages for you to look up on your own. So I want you to jot these down and then look them up. Grab a piece of paper and a notepad, and here they are. Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7. Joshua 23, verse 15. Judges 9, verse 23. 1 Samuel 16, verse 14. 1 Samuel 19, verse 9. 1 Kings 9, verse 9. Romans chapter 8, verse 20. Romans 11, verse 32. Now, I know some of you listening didn't jot those down, so I'm going to repeat them so you can actually jot them down and then look them up. Here they are. Isaiah chapter 45, verse 7. Joshua 23, verse 15. Judges 9, verse 23. 1 Samuel 16, verse 14. 1 Samuel 19, verse 9. 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 9. Romans 8, verse 20. And Romans 11, verse 32. I hope you enjoy your homework. As you read those verses, you're probably going to have a lot of questions come to mind, and that's okay. You know what? It's better than okay. It's good. My name is James Flanders, and I'm convinced that God is completely God in everything. I'm convinced that that first definition I read to you from Merriam-Webster is right, that God is a supreme or ultimate reality, the being perfect in power, wisdom, and goodness, and we're to worship him as creator and ruler of the universe. Be blessed, my friend. Be blessed.